the Mississippi watershed. So yes. Mississippi River, how much land do you think that drains?
Oh, really? Seriously?
Yes.
The things that we do on our local sites have an impact, not just to us, but to many other people.
I'm very passionate about the fact that woodland owners need options, and it can't be just about selling timber.
When you're putting out pollinator habitat, you're not just supporting pollinators. You're going to be supporting lots of different wildlife species.
As agriculture evolves and changes, are we, making sure that we are conserving our natural resources well, and are we, planning on preserving those?
Hey, welcome to Our Rich Land, a podcast of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District and Kingwood Center Gardens, where we, and by we, I mean you and us here at the table, all of us, we explore what it means to improve, protect, and conserve our natural world. I'm Josh Steffen. I'm the executive director at Kingwood Center Gardens in Mansfield, Ohio.
Also in Mansfield, Ohio, I am Evan Stern, a technician for Richland Soil and Water Conservation District. We have a jam-packed episode for you today talking about watersheds. We're going to get into the definition of a watershed, which, like I just
don't
said.
Leave us. Don't leave us at
don't,
this.
Don't leave us.
Don't leave us at Please. This extremely important nerding moment. Like, we just tuned you out because we're talking about watersheds and definitions.
Yep. So we're gonna also test Josh's knowledge on the subject.
Oh, boy. That should be quick. The frictional coefficient on that surface is very low.
Very low.
Boom, it's gone.
All right, you're up.
Oh, I'm up. Also, why watershed conservation is even important. I mean, we're investing massive amounts of our time sitting here talking to you about watersheds, so it must be important. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
How homeowners can participate and simultaneously manage water on their property, and also Evan Stern interviews Dan for a segment on rain garden and rain barrel stuff.
Perfect.
Wow, you didn't write this script on the fly at all. Very descriptive.
Yep. So Dan is another technician in our office, and I'm going to chat with him a little bit at the end of the episode about his perspective on things and what he does in the field for all that.
Sounds good.
Good stuff.
Let's collect our knowledge and retain it.
Sweet. Like stormwater.
Right.
Exactly.
That's what I'm saying.
On with the show. All right. And here we are back again.
We're in the executive suite of Kingwood Center Gardens,
right.
Talking watersheds.
Yeah.
One of my favorite topics.
Is it?
It is. I love soil and this is not to kiss up, but soil and water, they're two fundamental resources that every gardener, every land manager has to wrestle with, deal with. They're two resources. And
yep.
Way too often we see them as problems.
So how do we learn to understand, harness, and
work with what you got? It's the work with the cards you're dealt with.
Yeah.
It's the most sustainable. That's probably sustainable principle number one, resource wise and site wise.
Yeah.
But we're here to talk watersheds.
Yeah. So
woo, what's a watershed?
What the heck is a watershed?
Yeah. Tell me. You're the expert.
I have some notes.
Do you?
I got some notes.
Did you Wikipedia it?
So, if you don't know what a watershed is.
I don't. What's a watershed? Is that where I store my, jugs of water?
No, so it's an area of land that funnels all water that falls onto it to a specific point.
So, my roof is a watershed?
Technically, I guess so.
Yeah. The concept, any surface area.
The bottom of your downspout is the point of a watershed, technically. But, for the most part, when we're thinking watershed, we're thinking, creeks, creeks, streams, yeah. Rivers, and the like that typically flow into a body of water. Whether it's, a little pond that formed in your front yard or the Atlantic Ocean.
So there's natural watersheds, and then there's obviously constructed watersheds. It's a concept,
right,
that involves boundaries
surface area and square area and a point of exit for that water that collects to it.
Yeah, pretty much. When we're talking like big land area, and I forget exactly who came up with this. I think it's the U.S. Geological Survey came up with the HUCs, H-U-C, Hydrologic Unit Code.
Wow, you're getting nerdy.
I did my research.
Yeah.
So a HUC is a hydrologic unit code, and it's like
a HUC. I love it.
Yeah, there's an article I found. It was like,
is this one HUC or two HUCs?
What the heck is my HUC? Or something like that.
Careful when you Google that, folks. You might get some weird stuff that comes up. So
if you're a landowner, or if you want to know, like, what the heck is my watershed? Like, what's my watershed address? You can actually figure that out. So HUCs are, they go as small as, like, local streams and go way up to the big regions, at least for our country. So it's kind of like country, state, county, city, block is like a HUC. A HUC 2.
How do you spell that? H-U-K?
H-U-C.
H-U-C.
So a HUC 2, which basically is just two digits, like a two-digit code, is like the giant Mississippi watershed. Hey, actually, I need to make a quick correction here on that. The whole of the Mississippi watershed is not one HUC unit, like I said. So the watershed itself is split up into a handful of different two-digit HUCs, which are the largest HUC units formed by the USGS. Take a look in the show notes. I have included a link for the USGS's official HUC map, and you can see what I'm talking about. But as you keep going down, I think you add two digits. So the next smallest watershed is a HUC 4. And I think it goes all the way down to a HUC 12.
So that consists of 2 to 12 digits? I just know
2 to 12 digits.
Or I just looked it up on my phone. Okay.
Correct.
Hydrological unit codes. Got it.
And so there's a couple places where you can actually find your address that I found and that we use at Soil and Water is the US EPA's My Watershed website. On that site, you can actually search for your address or zip code and see what water bodies in your watershed are actually healthy or unhealthy. Mm. But it shows you what your local watershed is, the boundaries of it. And then US EPA is United States Environmental Protection Agency. And then USGS, which is the US Geological Survey, has a Science in Your Watershed tool, which offers links to information regarding watershed properties and health. But you can also search and kind of zoom in on where you live and find what watersheds you live in and where all that drains out. So,
okay. And then you guys
nerd is done.
What's that?
My nerding is done.
No, I think we should keep nerding. I'm silent for once because I'm looking this up because this is the first I've ever heard of a HUC. Yeah, no, okay. This is cool.
Yeah.
So you can nerd all you want, and you're teaching me some stuff here.
Talk about watersheds.
So I have a few questions for you, Josh.
Oh boy.
The Mississippi watershed. So yes. Mississippi River, how much land do you think that drains?
Oh, really? Seriously?
Yes.
Well, you know, we can't forget that the Ohio River is a tributary, which is
crazy.
Crazy. And it's not a small river system in itself. Neither is, oh crap. Isn't the Missouri flow into the Mississippi also?
Correct.
Jiminy Frost. It's the entire central core of the United States. 30 million acres.
Well, my numbers in miles.
Or 1 million.
My numbers in miles. So.
Oh.
So I'm not sure what that is.
10 million square miles. 400,000 square miles.
So, no. 10 million is quite an overshot, actually.
Really? I know. Actually. That's shocking that I would overshoot something.
1.15.
Oh, I was so close. Come on.
Million square miles.
Billion square miles?
No, million.
Oh, okay. I was going to say. I was darn close then compared to a billion. That 10 million is pretty darn close.
But because most of you probably have no clue what that
is. I have no conception of what that means.
It's an area that's larger than the country of Argentina. So all are part of around 31 states and two Canadian provinces.
No wonder New Orleans gets a bunch of crap.
All right, next question.
Okay.
What is the nation's largest estuary? And we should probably start with what is an estuary. So,
an estuary, it is a coastal tidal zone. It's an edge. It's an ecotone.
Ooh. Nice.
Yeah, you like that? I'm throwing that in there. It's an ecotome, which is where two edges of different ecosystems overlap and interact, and they're very dynamic in nature. So you have land meeting, you know, water, or meeting ocean, and so where those two meet, you have a tidal zone and an estuary. Is probably some version of that, but it's when I think of nursery or estuary, I think of nursery.
Yeah,
you know, because the reason why it's such a breeding ground for different animals, because there's such a confluence of resources coming in from two different, that's why an ecotone is so dynamic.
Yeah.
And so you get mixing of different resources.
And then did you say it's like, did you say the mix about saltwater, freshwater? So it's estuaries.
It's also where freshwater and saltwater mix.
Right, because it's like a river delta meeting the ocean.
Right, it's kind of like a river delta meeting the ocean, right? Thanks for feeding that information to me so that you'll edit this into one coherent answer that'll make me sound like I know what I'm talking about.
And that mixing of salt and fresh is called brackish water. So it's like a kind of fresh kind of salt water. So the nation's largest estuary, what do you think?
Well, I always think of like Monterey Bay and, you know, that area of California, but I wonder if somewhere in Alaska or Toledo, Ohio.
Toledo.
the New Orleans, like the Mississippi Delta, is that kind of a build off of that same question?
No, actually it's the Chesapeake.
Oh.
So down over there by Eastern Virginia.
Yes.
Is the nation's largest estuary.
That's another big draining system.
But getting to the world's largest river watershed, so it's not the Mississippi.
No. I could see the Yangtze or Nile or the Elbe,
directly south of us. About 4,000 miles, probably.
About 4,000 miles. In South America?
Just guessing. Yeah.
I don't know. Yep. What's the river? Oh, the Amazon.
Amazon River.
I'm really on it here, folks.
Talk about watersheds.
So why is it important at the big scale, and we can talk obviously in the local scale, why the heck is this all so important for water conservation, you know, reasons? Why is the concept of it seems like watershed is like sort of foundational to everything you guys do.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the principle of watershed conservation and why it's so important is because every inch of land is part of a watershed.
That's deep, man.
So so whatever is done on a watershed as far as land use, land cover, what kind of activities are being done is all affecting a watershed in some way. So watershed conservation is almost like one of the most basic, I mean, water conservation in general is one of the most basic natural resources
management things. Yeah, sure.
Along with soil, and they are intertwined extensively. But sure. Yeah, community and societal health really depends on the health of the watershed, and there's a lot of reasons why that is.
What's a couple of them?
So first, poor water quality affects the functionality and health of aquatic ecosystems. So the species that live there and all their interconnections, and also, you know, those interconnections expand beyond the aquatic ecosystem into terrestrial ecosystems. Secondly, human health is pretty dependent on water quality. Thinking about Lake Erie's toxic algal blooms. So, I mean, a lot of people depend on Lake Erie's water for drinking, recreational activities, transport, that kind of thing. So Lake Erie, a lot of people in Ohio know about Lake Erie's issues and how it's kind of shown us a big need for comprehensive watershed health. So a little bit later on in the program, I'm going to talk to you about H2 Ohio, which is what the state is doing to combat the problems in the Lake Erie watershed that are contributing to Lake Erie's algal blooms.
So let's talk
let's do it.
Basic conservation principles that can be applied when you're working with a site. I don't care if it's at the state and regional level or down to the homeowner. As a designer, I look at when I do a site analysis.
Yeah.
What are all the resource and energy flows that come on and off the site? You got to list them. Your soil, your sun level, you know, your sun and light levels. Mm-hmm. You want to capture those resources and use them as much as you can in different ways before they're released.
Yeah.
Okay. And ecosystems do this naturally. Mm-hmm. Ecosystems will capture. Think of sunlight. And the energy transfer chain through the food, you know, the food chain, the food web.
Yeah.
That they are great at harvesting and capturing most of that sunlight energy, mm-hmm. translating into a bazillion different forms through plants. And then, you know, our bodies are running on starlight that's been captured by plants, right? All that mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah.
So water is another big one.
Yep.
Airflow, all these things you're looking at.
Yep.
And with water, you want to capture that water that comes on the property, slow it down, store it, and use it as much as possible for it, and store it as high on the land as possible.
Yeah. Okay.
Right where it enters.
Yeah.
Preferably, and you know, depending on your grade, you know, for us, it's in the very south. Our water, basically, on Kingwood site, travels from the south. West corner to the northeast mm-hmm. through various means. We have a fairly drastic shift in topography here,
right,
for some of the areas. So second, and there's a lot of different ways the homeowner can store that. You can do it through ponds. You can, mm-hmm. but one thing that people don't think about is you store it through plants mm-hmm. and especially trees.
Yeah.
Okay. And soil amendment. So real simple ways to store water, think of compost mm-hmm. and organic matter in the soil. Compost can hold and absorb like a sponge up to 35% its weight. Mm. Okay. It's almost the same amount as clay. So think about that.
Really?
So it absorbs it mm-hmm. quickly, I put that in quotes, and slowly releases it back to the ground as things around it dry out. So storing water, you may not be able to dig a pond, but everybody can spread compost. Mm-hmm. Water or woody plants, especially trees, the woody adaption is not only to help it hold it upright, but it's an adaption against extreme temperature and water changes.
Yeah.
So that tree trunk is storing a whole lot of water in it mm-hmm. and energy. So plant more trees, you'll store more water. Right. So those are a couple of out of the box thinking. We've been talking rain gardens and rivers and chains. But one of the best ways to design storage, water storage, that's really low tech, mm-hmm. is your plant material.
Yeah.
Right. Planting plants, of course, that are deep rooted. Why does that? Because it opens deep channels for the water to trickle down around the roots and down into the. So we'll talk about that later with the rain garden.
Yeah.
So those are so slow the water down, store it, reuse it as much as you can. Mm-hmm. And then obviously planting appropriate material. You got to know how much water's coming on the site. And then you also got to know your soil characteristics and do a percolation test. This is especially important if you're designing a rain garden, to have this information as you're designing the rain garden. And usually it's put into the calculations.
Gotcha.
So there's two words in groundwater, you know, infiltration is the actual entry of the water into the soil profile. And then percolation is the movement of that water. You think of percolation in a coffee grounds, right? It's moving through the grounds. So percolation is the movement of water actually through the soil once it's in the soil.
Yeah.
So what you do is you dig a pit. It can be, usually it's like maybe 12 inches by 12 inches by 12 inches deep. And then you take, say, a gallon of water or whatever you want to do, but gallon's easy.
Yeah.
You pour it into the pit, and then you set a timer. And then that will tell you, I mean, it's real simple.
So it's more low tech than I was thinking.
Yeah, it's really low tech. You know, did it take, you know, 20 minutes for a gallon of water to disappear completely? Did it take a day? Well, that water, the more it can percolate through rather than run off, is really slowing it down.
Yeah.
Right. But short of massive costs of digging up all that soil and making it more drainable, quote unquote, you're going to have to know that number because it's going to drastically affect your size of pond storage. The slower it percolates, the bigger the vessel has to be to hold it until it can go off.
Yeah.
Right. The bigger the outflow pipe has to be.
Right.
So all of those, the percolation, that's one of the most important numbers going into any kind of watershed management design. You got to know how much rain are you designing for? What's the boundaries of the area that you're draining in terms of square footage or square inches or whatever? Mm-hmm. And then where is that draining to and how fast do you want to release that? Mm-hmm. Those are all kind of the basic questions.
Talk about watersheds.
Hello, our Richland fans. If you dig this podcast, please share with a friend. Like, subscribe, embed it into stone somewhere for you to be able to remember. It means a lot.
As always, everybody, thanks for listening. And we hope you've been enjoying this episode on watershed conservation and how you as an individual can educate yourself and even take steps on your own land and in your own community to address watershed health. Don't worry, there's more on this to come. Richland Soil and Water Conservation District seeks to educate and guide the citizens of Richland County, Ohio, towards their conservation goals and to be a leader in natural resource stewardship in our community. We are actually in our 75th year,
woohoo,
and still going strong, offering ample programming, resources, and technical assistance wherever is necessary. We are the administrators for the county's stormwater management and sediment control regulations, which translates down to us handling the stormwater permitting for residential, commercial, and agricultural building projects. And we do all that in the unincorporated areas of Richland County and the Village of Lexington. These regulations were developed to help our local watersheds by requiring homeowners, builders, and developers to actively take steps to prevent erosion from construction sites, and that helps to keep our waters clear of excess sediment. Also, like I mentioned earlier, we administer a program from the state called H2 Ohio. This is a state program that the Ohio Department of Agriculture, the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, and the Ohio Department of Natural Resources are all partnering in on. The Department of Ag's portion of this program entails helping farmers to adopt conservation practices that they can put on their farm and on their ground. As part of the program, my coworker Jordan and I work with a handful of local farmers who are implementing fertilizer management practices and working to decrease the potential for nutrients that they apply to their farms and fields to wash away into nearby waterways. We also do much more than just these two programs. So if you are interested in what else we do and where we're doing it, please visit our website. You may have been to our website before, especially if you're a regular around our office or if you volunteer. you might actually find it a little bit different than when you left it. That's because our brand new website design is finally up and ready, and it's going. So check that out. From there, you can find our calendar of events. It's right on the front page. And you can also call our office, 419-747-8686, for any of these resources as well. Josh, what's Kingwood all about?
Well, you know, as I say all the time, we're about helping people to connect deeply to the natural world, to each other, to, you know, meaningful experiences of a exquisite historic garden estate that Mr. King set up and provided. We do it through, like we've said, many different means and methods, through public events, you know, through private rentals and opportunities, through classes, especially. But it's just, and even the most important is the daily interaction, you know, visitation, just being there and enjoying the peacocks and the ducks and the flowers and the trees and the shrubs and the mansion and all that Mr. King left for us to steward and care.
And the, correct me if I'm wrong, but the duck pond is complete.
Finite. Well, at least one phase of it, yeah. Okay. We'll have more, you know, plantings, and I have other plans for it down the road. So if you're interested in being a contributor of any sizable amount to help us continue that, developing that, I would be happy to talk to you at some point. Come visit us.
RichlandSWCD.net is how you can reach us. And then what's Kingwood's?
KingwoodCenter.org.
Hey everyone. So since we were talking about watersheds this episode, and we mentioned some really big ones earlier on, I wanted to make sure that we touch on the local ones right here in Richland County. So Richland County actually has 8 watersheds that either fully or partially fall within the county's boundaries. They are Three Forks, Four Uppers, and the Huron. So the Clear Fork, the Black Fork, and the Rocky Fork, the Upper Sandusky, the Upper Olentangy, the Upper Vermilion, and the Upper Kokosing, and then, like I said, the Huron River. But like we said in the first half of the episode, watersheds can be huge swaths of land, but every watershed can be broken down to smaller and smaller units, kind of like nesting dolls.
For instance, we're next to the Clear Fork, a river that runs through Richland County from the Clear Fork Reservoir, running through the villages of Lexington, Belleville, and Butler, dumping into Pleasant Hill Lake, and eventually joining the Black Fork near Loudonville to become the Mohican River.
Then the Mohican River joins with the Kokosing River to form the Walhonding River, which joins the Tuscararas farther down to form the Muskingum River, which is a major tributary of the Ohio River. So eventually it'll dump out down into the Ohio River. The Ohio River now is a tributary of the Mississippi River, so all that water goes out past Cincinnati and down towards Illinois, and eventually hundreds and hundreds of miles later and farther south ends up in the Gulf of Mexico.
Now, some of you may not know that Ohio is actually split between a couple of large-scale watersheds that generally flow in two opposite directions. They are the Mississippi River watershed, the one we just talked about, and the Great Lakes watershed, where the water runs out through the St. Lawrence Seaway and out into the northern Atlantic Ocean. This is what is called a continental divide, which is a boundary that separates the water flowing to two or more different water bodies. There are actually 6 divides in North America. The one running through Ohio is called the St. Lawrence Divide, and of course the famous one is the Great Divide that follows the Rocky Mountains.
The St. Lawrence Divide actually runs through Richland County itself. So if you live on the very north end of the county, your water likely goes north into Lake Erie, while water in the Mansfield area and south goes towards the Ohio River.
We encourage you to check out our website to learn more about Richland County's watersheds. We have several engaging resources for you. The first being our interactive watershed map, where you can search for your address to find which local watershed you live in and discover the unique paths of each river and their tributaries. Speaking of tributaries, doing what I do with the MS4, the NPDES program, we have wandered through quite a few of the tributaries here in Richland County. And I'm here to tell you there's quite a few.
We have another interactive map that is all about water quality data. We have dedicated volunteers that monitor precipitation at home or sample water bodies around the county. And then their data is displayed on this map and can give the viewer real-time precipitation measurements and stream and lake quality updates. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. We also have a page on our website where you can get directions to go on a driving tour of the Continental Divide in Richland County. There is a map on this page that shows where the divide is and the many points of interest along the way. The page will actually allow you to download directions to tour the divide starting from wherever you are at. You can also copy the coordinates provided at the points of interest on the map into a navigation app that you use.
And lastly, in order to help further educate the public on the Continental Divide in Richland County, we had some signs made up and will be put on many of the county roads that cross the divide. These signs are white and green with our logo on them, and will tell you whether you're entering the Lake Erie watershed or Ohio River watershed. So keep your eyes peeled as you're headed on some county roads. And as always, the link to our website will be in the show notes. I will link the specific pages we just mentioned as well. Thanks for bearing with us, and let's get back to my conversation with Josh.
Talk about watersheds.
What else would there be in your experience
of like water management,
yeah,
that kind of thing,
and with watershed design and questions you got to answer at the outset when you're creating something?
Well, you talked about the storage, which is critical. Talking about how much, like what your land usage is, like how much impervious surface, I know is pretty important.
Because that affects your percolation rate.
And how much storage you might need. Because if you have enough storage for your calculated storm events currently, but then you decide to add a nice big old pole barn that has a 40 by 60 roof on it, that's going to go into the same storage. Hey, everybody. I'm going to play a clip for you from last episode where Mark Roofner, an engineer from local firm K.E. McCartney, explains storm events, I think, as succinctly as I've ever heard.
It's really more a percent, like a likelihood of occurring. So a one-year rain event would be an event that's likely to occur once per year. In reality, that rain event could happen multiple times per year, or we may not get it for 3 or 4 or 5 years. But the likelihood is it will happen once per year. And that would be like somewhere around 2.5 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. And whereas like a 100-year rainfall event would be over 5.5 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. So based on historical data, we would expect a 100-year event only happen once every 100 years, or there's a 1% chance of that rain event occurring every year.
So it's not hard surface isn't just the concrete parking lot. It's the hardscape roof. It's all of those things.
Pretty much any impervious surface, which means water can't make it through and has to be, taken somewhere else. So I know when our office does a lot of commercial permits, we're, taking a business's stormwater management plans that they've sent into us and doing some preliminary checks to make sure that their stormwater BMPs are in place. So
which are what?
The best management practices. Okay. And there's there's specific designs to kind of slow down water, to hold and contain water. I know a lot of homeowners don't have their own catch basin. Some have ponds that they run their stormwater to, but...
Well, let's use the example of a rain garden.
Okay.
To make this at a scale that everybody can relate to, but the engineers that worked on the Gateway project here use the same process. People who are doing regulations for the EPA are using the same, you know, they're setting up the same parameters and forcing you to answer the same questions.
Yeah.
That you would for a rain garden. By the way, another storage method, of course, is a rain barrel. There's another storage method. Let's not forget that one. Okay, so a rain garden. So I've built one or two, and we have a good example here on site. First step in that is, again, define your watershed area. You need to know the actual square footage of your roof that you're collecting it off of,
and
its surrounding area that you want to, you know, on the ground. Mm-hmm. Then you know where it's getting outed to. In this case, it's usually a drain pipe, you know, a downspout.
Yep.
And then you got to know your percolation rate, because that one, that water hits the ground, it's either running off or it's going into the ground. It's got one of those two options.
Yep.
So if you're trying to slow it down, you need to know how fast it's going to sink into the ground.
Yeah.
And that will affect the depth and the width of your, and you know, all those three dimensions of creating that bowl.
Yeah.
Often it's, you put a French drain in the very bottom of it, especially if it doesn't percolate. It's another way. Yeah. And then you'll pick out your plant material. Always encourage native plant material. That is that can handle the wet feet, but don't like to sit in water. So those facultative wetland plants. And it's great to use, you know, shrub, woody plants. So diversity of plant material, both herbaceous and root, diversity of root system, fibrous and tap. Mm-hmm. And you get that all put in there.
And fibrous is like long stringy hair roots.
Yeah.
And tap is like...
Right. Carrot hair. is a tap root, tap right? Root. And perennial grass, your turf grass. That's fibrous.
Yeah.
Fibrous. Your grasses are all pretty much fibrous. And the different diversity, they have different functions in a wetland system.
Yeah.
So you get all your plant material in there too. And it's really nothing more complicated than that with wetland. You know how fast you want to release it based on the amount of the worst case scenario that you want to really plan for.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's that 1 year or the 10 year. The wetland that we did, or the rain garden I did in my last job, I think I planned for, was that a 10-year event?
Okay.
So basically 2.5 to 3 inches of water over a 24-hour period. Mm-hmm. Then just planted the crap out of it with, you know, native plant material.
Yeah.
A lot of sedges in our case. So that's the process that you basically go through. Whenever you're working with any kind of, whether it's a commercial and they're designing retention pond systems, you know, they know they have to release it at a certain rate. Mm-hmm. that will define how deep it is. And unfortunately, a lot of times they plant it with grass on the sides. Mm-hmm. And then you end up with these retention ponds with a lot of you know, algae blooming, and it's nasty, disgusting looking. And
but yeah, like yours down here, like
at the at Kingwood.
Here at Kingwood, sorry. Like until Mark said it, I said that it was your detention base, and I was like, oh, duh, that makes sense. It's your big pond at the bottom of your mm-hmm. property.
Mm-hmm.
But does it scream detention pond?
No.
It's like a little forested
pond. Yeah. And it's in the rain garden that we have outside of our carriage courthouse area. And it's got a nice stainless steel sculpture in it now. Very small, but it's only pulling from a certain part of the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very nice and artistic, but it's planted with you know, a lot of Japanese iris and other things that, again, they like those temporary, you know, periods of having their feet wet. Mm-hmm. And the soil saturated, so low oxygen levels, but they're not adapted to that on a permanent basis. Mm-hmm. Unlike other plants that are obligatory that need to be in standing water pretty much the entire season.
Mm-hmm.
So planning right plant, right place based on your design is critical.
talk about watersheds.
Hey, everyone. We're back with Dan Harold for another segment that has to do with stormwater. This episode, we've been talking about watersheds and some more specific strategies for homeowners to manage stormwater on their own properties. If you heard or remembered from last episode, we had Dan on talking about the MS4 program, the Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System. One of the requirements of OEPA for the MS4 program for our county is to have educational programming. And then one of the ways that we meet that requirement is to do some specific workshops and training. So, Dan, you want to get into that a little bit?
Sure. So, we offer generally at least one. So far, it's been many more than one rain garden, rain barrel workshops throughout the year.
What do you guys talk about kind of specifically in these workshops? We kind of already defined what a rain garden is in this episode, but what's a rain barrel and how do you teach people about those?
Let's get technical. Okay. So the definition, the definition of a rain barrel is, it's a container that's used to collect and store rainwater that would otherwise be lost to our storm drains or stormwater runoff.
Okay.
So why don't we want this rainwater going across the ground, or why don't we want it going across your driveway, or what's the whole point behind a rain barrel? So our concern with rainwater is, yeah, it's great. We need to have it. It's got to be there. That's how we survive. But as it starts running across solid surfaces or even your yard, it picks up contaminants. And as it picks up those contaminants or pollutants, it has to go somewhere. And as this rainwater runs off, you'll see it go into storm drains, or you'll see it go into public waterways. And of course, as it does that, it's transferring antifreeze or oils or fertilizers or whatever into these public waterways. And that's where this concern comes in. So one of the ways to stop that is with rain barrels.
So, and we've talked about in the last couple episodes about collecting water as high on the land or as soon as possible as you can to kind of slow down the movement of water across property and to kind of stop all those pollutants from getting into the waterways and on down through watersheds. So for reference for our homeowners, what are some success stories that you've seen?
Okay. So I'm going to start out with a rain garden for the first one.
All right.
We had a homeowner here in Richland County that was constantly struggling with his garage flooding. So he had tried to do some things on his own. He put in a drain tile. He tried rerouting his downspouts. And just continued to struggle with this. What was happening is the water was coming down his downspouts from his garage, and the way the land is laid out beside his garage, the water actually flows right back into his garage. So as it came out, it just went right back. Oh, so it was just like a big time negative. And then anytime it rained, of course, not only did he have that water coming from his downspouts going back towards his building, but then he also had the rain that was landing on that surface and getting surface flow of the water back towards its garage. So he invested in a 60-gallon rain barrel, thinking that would take care of it. And without getting into a whole lot of detail, when you get an inch of rain on a specific hard surface, you get quite a bit of runoff. So that 60-gallon rain barrel was filled up within, the first 15-20 minutes of that inch of rain that he got. So it was great there for a while. He was like, he's standing out in the garage and he was all kinds of happy because his garage was dry, and he's like, man, I finally figured it out. And of course, as soon as the rain barrel filled up, then right back to flooding he was.
Yikes.
So he gave us a call here at the district, and he's like, listen, you know, I'm kind of fit to be tied here. Do you guys have any ideas? And so I got with Jordan Keller, one of our other technicians, mm-hmm. and he and I kind of talked it out and came up with the idea of a rain garden. So we went out and spoke to this homeowner and explained what a rain garden was, because he had kind of heard of them, but not real clear on what it was. Mm-hmm. Went through the whole process with him, got some things figured out, and we actually ended up helping him to install the rain garden. Mm-hmm. And we had some, it was really pretty cool. We had some interns. We had three high school interns that were working with us that summer. So we got to involve them in the process as well. Mm-hmm. But within the first year after the plants were put in, the flooding for the most part stopped, unless we got an inch and a half or more of rain. Mm-hmm. Within the second year, when the plants had matured really well, he hasn't been experiencing any flooding at all.
That's cool.
So yeah, I mean, it completely took care of his flooding issue.
Was the water managed solely by soil and plants, or was there an under drain installed?
So in this one,
or French drain, or something like that.
What ended up happening was as we helped him to, you know, put this together, we found that he was the area where he wanted to put this rain garden to work was in a very clayey area. So a lot of clay type soil, which, as I'm sure you're well aware, doesn't absorb water very well. It's not like sandy or loamy soil. So yeah, in this case, he kind of himself turned it into more of a bio swale than a rain garden. He put a drain in the center of it. So whenever, like, normally the only time he has a problem is when we get 3 inches or more of rain, and then the water will just sit, and in order to get rid of it, he puts a pump down in this drain that he installed.
Oh, okay.
And pumps the water out so the plants don't die out. But still, even with that, the water goes into the rain garden and it doesn't flood out his garage. So he did accomplish his mission. He just wanted to make sure that, you know, he could probably let it go for a while and the plants would be fine, but yeah. Just to be safe, he's getting that cleared out.
Okay. How about a rain barrel?
So really, any rain barrel that's installed, that's, you know, filled by rainwater, is a good thing, because we're preventing all that runoff, from, as I said earlier, from picking up chemicals, that are on the ground, and taking them to our public waterways. Your native plants, gardens and lawns will love the water too, because the water is naturally soft. The most recent success story I heard, and you may think this is kind of funny, because it's completely unrelated, was when we lost power for a week when the tornado went through. Mm. And a lot of people were actually using that water to flush their toilets with.
Yeah.
They were using it to fill their tanks, their toilet tanks, and then using it to flush. But I mean, if you don't have any water, where else are you going to get it? So in this case, it was great that they had these rain barrels, mm-hmm. because they were some of the few in their area that could actually continue using their bathrooms. So, so kind of a neat thing, but yeah, your plants really, really like it. So the one thing with the water that comes out of your rain barrel is and this is our disclaimer, is we strongly recommend that you don't drink that water.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of people say, well, what if you filter it? What if you did? Well, regardless, we strongly recommend you don't drink that water. Because of course, as the rain hits your roof, it could pick up any contaminants that are on your roof, like the tar, of course, the sand or the gravel that's on your shingles. Biggest thing is, you know, what flies in the air over your roof that may make a deposit on your shingles.
Right, exactly.
Bird droppings are the other issue. So filtering it or not, we'd still recommend that, of course, that you don't drink that water, but your plants love it.
Yeah, it's fantastic for watering plants.
Yep.
Well, Dan, really appreciate you coming back on again imparting your knowledge and wisdom.
That's scary. That's scary. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks for being back on.
Talk about watersheds.
Our Rich Land is a production of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District and Kingwood Center Gardens
in Mansfield, Ohio. For those of you who are extra inspired by today's episode and you haven't already tuned us out to listen to your next true crime podcast, and you don't think it's a crime that we've been occupying your eardrum space, here are some further resources for your edumacation. down in the show notes. The nerd section.
Yes. That's a good name for it. We should call it the nerd
from now on.
The nerd section.
The nerd section.
Perfect. We mentioned that one article, What the Heck Is My Huck? That is an actual article by the Texas Floodplain Management Association.
I want to be president of that.
So to find out more about hucks and what they are, there's that link below. And also in the show notes, I will include a link to the US EPA's watershed website that I mentioned at the beginning of the episode. But I got the name of the website wrong when I talked about it earlier. The actual name of the website is How's My Waterway. And the cool thing about this website is that you can actually figure out which HUC 12 watershed that you live in. For example, for Richland County, this would include any of the 8 watersheds that we talked about earlier in the episode. But as far as I know, this tool is nationwide, as it is hosted by the US EPA. So go check that out if you are curious to know what HUC 12 you live in. Also, this website gives you an idea of the health of the watershed you live in, and provides more information for you to explore in that regard.
And if you want to nerd out further, the U.S. Geological Survey has a Science in Your Watershed tool.
This is also a website. Yep.
Yeah, it's a website. Once you know your watershed, you can find it here. They also have, on the same website, long lists of links and more additional info on watersheds.
Hey everyone, it's Dan from Soil and Water chiming in here. A reminder that we have interactive maps available to explore the watersheds and water quality in Richland County. Like we said before, these are found on Richland SWCD's website, and the links will be in the show notes. Also, we have a new website, and it's pretty sleek. It is the same web address, richlandswcd.net, so go check it out. Also, for the Rain Barrel and Rain Garden workshops, check our calendar of events for when and where those will be. So, if you are looking for stormwater management advice or how to control and utilize water on your property, these are very good workshops to attend. You may also call our office or stop by to chat about these things. Phone number and address for us is listed on our website.